Hello, I'm Keith Perron. Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Advocates for full West Papuan membership in the Melanesian Spearhead Group are not giving up despite glaring divisions over the matter in the sub-regional grouping. This month in Honiara, MSG leaders deferred a decision on an application for full membership to the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, which is currently has an observer status. The Liberation Movement says the deferral did not, as Indonesian officials claim, an amount to a rejection. But as Johnny Blaze reports, MSG leaders say the group's secretariat must first develop more clear guidelines for membership.
Vanuatu's Prime Minister says since last year, membership criteria has been developed which stipulates full members needing to be a Melanesian state, tending towards trade relations. Shalu Sawai says the MSG secretariat has been tasked with coming up with criteria which better reflects the group's founding principles, namely to assist the self-determination of Melanesian peoples. He points out that one of the full MSG members, New Caledonia's FLNKS Canucks movement, is not a state, but a political movement aspiring for independence. This, Mr. Sawai says, sets a precedent for the West Papuans to have full membership. However, Papua New Guinea's Foreign Minister Rimbink Pato says the FLNKS situation is different to the West Papuans.
No, FLNKS, they were right there in the beginning and they have come a long way and they've taken a completely different route in terms of the issues that require their inclusion and consideration for full membership. And their agendas, for example, going through the process recognized by international law is the issue of decolonization in the UN.
In recent months, large numbers of West Papuans have been mobilizing in Papuan cities to express support for the liberation movement, which at times has resulted in mass arrests. An Australian-based Papuan student, Yaman Kagoya, said fellow Papuans who demonstrated elsewhere in the Indonesian Republic now face heavy monitoring by the security forces. He says Indonesian police and civilian militia assaulted those involved in one particular demo by the Papuan student alliance in Yogyakarta to time with the Honiara summit.
Basically what happened was that the Indonesian police and also security forces, they don't like the citizens, these students. They're not just a Papuan student, but also they're citizens of Indonesia. They are not allowed to express their voice freely, democratically.
While MSG countries are limited in their influence over Indonesian state actions in Papua, their importance as an international bloc has grown as the plight of West Papuans has become more internationalised. Shalu Sawai says the MSG must unite to overcome divisions over the issue.
We have to understand and find a way to support our brothers of Melanesia to get what they want. We want self-determination, so why we are supporting FLNKS and not supporting WMP? If we believe in Melanesian culture, we should not turn away to continue to unite, because the benefits of having UMSG is huge for Melanesian countries.
MSG leaders are expected to further discuss the Liberation Movement's application in Port Vila in September. This is Johnny Blades.
Some South Pacific Island countries claim to lucrative fishing and seabed mining resources could be limited by a landmark ruling on the South China Sea. Experts say this month's decision by the Permanent Court of Arbitration could also mean an uptick in China's help to the Pacific region. Sally Round reports.
Experts say the ruling is hugely significant for the development of the law of the sea, partly because it clarifies how to determine whether a land feature is an island or a rock, and that has a bearing on how much resource-rich surrounding sea a country can claim. An international law of the sea specialist, Donald Rothwell, says the ruling may have a knock-on effect on Pacific Island countries' control of their huge fishing resource, with possible challenges to the extent of exclusive economic zones.
we may well see not only a redrawing of the maritime entitlements in the South China Sea, but also in some of these closely contested areas in the Pacific where we have a mix of islands whose status is not really in doubt, but very small maritime features who are very remote, but which some South Pacific states may well have been seeking to rely upon to extend their maritime entitlements even further into the Pacific.
But Professor Rothwell says it's most unlikely the ruling would unravel arrangements on maritime boundaries in the region, which have already been settled. But disputed areas such as Minerva Reef, which is claimed by both Fiji and Tonga, could now well come under renewed scrutiny. Fiji doesn't recognise Tonga's annexation of the reef in 1972, and 5 years ago destroyed its navigational beacons there. Professor Rothwell says the inherent worth of the reef is now quite different as a result of the decision.
It may well seek to dampen some of the aspirations of the claimants because the reef might now be quite properly characterised as nothing more than being entitled to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea as opposed to a very expansive maritime claim to an exclusive economic zone and continental shelf.
China refused to participate in the tribunal's proceedings and says it will ignore the ruling, but has since indicated it'll seek to maintain peace and stability in the South China Sea. So could there be any effect on the geopolitics of the Pacific Island region, which has seen a beefed-up US presence in the last few years? A defence analyst at Wellington Centre for Strategic Studies, Paul Sinclair, says there definitely will be.
What we might see in terms of the South Pacific is China redoubling its efforts to provide aid and other assistance in an effort to try and build up its soft diplomacy in the region and elsewhere.
A scholar of China's strategic affairs at Australia's Bond University, Rosita Delios, expects China will up its profile in the Pacific. She says China wants to be seen as a great power contributing to global order, despite not taking part in the South China Sea's case.
Of course they protested, but they will take on board anything that might detract from their image as a great power which is attractive and not simply displaying economic power or military power. It would like to have friends. It wants to cultivate friends. I think we'll see more soft power, more efforts to strategize about its developmental role.
Guam, which houses a US military base, has called on China to respect the ruling. This is Sally Round.
A Sudanese man who fled war and persecution and who was injured in riots in Manus Island in PNG has now been secretly deported from Melbourne to Christmas Island. Daniel Webb from the Human Rights Law Centre in Australia says the deportation, which happened this week, happened under the cover of darkness with no notice given to the man's lawyer. He says the man, who is using the pseudonym Waled, spent 3 years being moved from centre to centre and was treated in Australia for his injuries sustained in the riot that killed Reza Bhatti. Waled still hasn't had his refugee application processed. In April, almost 200 asylum seekers were granted community detention in Australia, many of them with young children. Daniel Webb told Alex Perolte asylum seekers in Australia now live in fear.
This was a secretive deportation under the cover of darkness without any notice to the man himself, without any notice to his friends and without any notice to his lawyer. And I've got to say, you know, I'm concerned about what this deportation means for him. I mean, it's a terrifying thing to be woken up in the middle of the night and bundled onto a plane. It's particularly terrifying when you've fled war and persecution. And right now, he will be very frightened that the next step for him is removal to Manus Island.
And what was his status? I'm guessing he had not been granted refugee status.
Well, he hasn't even had his refugee claims assessed yet. So this guy has been in detention on different islands and different detention centres around the place for the last 3 years. He's been beaten by guards at the Manus Detention Centre. He still has not had his refugee claims resettled. And we've got to realise in this country that it's just not okay to lock up innocent people indefinitely in tiny islands and bounce them around the Pacific like they're sort of pawns on a chessboard. We need to assess their refugee claims, and if they're found to be refugees, allow them to begin rebuilding their lives.
And what does this mean now? Because I think it was April, we had hundreds of people that were released into what's called community detention. That's many people with families, some people who had health issues that were brought from Nauru and Manus Island. We've been told that some of them have received calls from the Department of Immigration threatening that they too could be deported. What do you know about that, and what sort of fears do they harbour?
Well, they're going to be terrified that they're next. I mean, this is one of the first actions of the new Malcolm Turnbull government. And this is not letting people stay. Secretive deportations to tiny islands in the middle of the night is not letting people stay. Now, right now around Australia, there will be 300 people. We're talking about 37 babies who were born in Australia. We're talking about children, many of whom are going to be in classrooms around Australia as we speak. Them and their families are going to be really frightened by what happened last night, and they're going to be really concerned that they're next. And I think it's well and truly time to realise these people have suffered enough. It's time to stop punishing them. It's time to let them stay.
The Vanuatu Chamber of Commerce is opposing a suggested new income tax as the Vanuatu government reviews taxes to help increase government funds. Business people have instead proposed a sales tax increase hike value-added tax by 2.5% to 15%. A member of the Chamber of Commerce, Martin Harari, spoke to Indira Stewart.
It will be really costly to implement an income tax system. Each VATU that you're going to collect with income tax, it might cost half a VATU or two VATU. It might cost more at first and for a few years on the country to implement that system than the amount that they're going to collect. So just increasing the VAT would be really, really easy. It's less damaging to the economy a lot if you increase VAT than if you install income tax. It's really, in Vanuatu, the only 5% of the population that has more than a high school degree. So it's really difficult to have skilled employee here, to have a surgeon, to have a dentist, to have lawyers, to have anything that is needed in a developed society to work.
Right, so there wouldn't have been many professional workers to tax anyway if there wasn't a new income tax.
Reports show that there are only 26,000 people that are actually registered at the VNPF, the Vanuatu National Pension Plan. Okay, so that's less than 10% of the population that is in the formal economy that receive a paycheck. And that 26,000, that includes all the people that earn really low wage. As soon as you earn more than 5,000 VATU, so $50 US per month, you have to be registered at the pension plan. So there's really a small pool of people that you're going to be able to tax for personal income. It's quite popular, these income tax, with voters. There's a possibility that government decide to go ahead with that. It's a luxury, in my opinion, that Vanuatu cannot afford at this stage.
In terms of increasing the value-added tax, do you think that you will get much of a pushback from business owners and consumers because products will be obviously more expensive?
It's really not popular to increase income tax, to increase VAT either. There's also other proposition to raise the land rent and to raise the fees, the business license fees, the work permit fees of 20%. It would be bad if we kill the chicken that laid the egg. It has to be done cautiously and with the right mix. It's not about raising VAT to 15%. It's more about income tax. It's not a good solution. Please look at other options.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Those who listen to this program on shortwave at various times and frequencies, I just want to tell you about a new time and frequency that we have added. And that's Fridays. Fridays at 22 hours UTC. Fridays at 22 hours UTC on 9,955 kilohertz. And that's a program that is beamed to the southern part of North America, the Caribbean, and Latin America. And we are going to be issuing special Focus Asia Pacific EQSLs if you tune in. And the email address for that is the same one for the program, which I will give out later on in the program. A Papua New Guinea economist has put forward a proposal to open up the whole island of New Guinea to trade. Charles Yali is the director of the National Research Institute, a PNG government-funded think tank. His opinion, Pierce argues, that both Indonesia and Papua New Guinea would benefit from opening up their land borders for trade purposes. He spoke to Corey Hawkins about his idea.
Knowing very well that there are social, political, cultural, environmental, topographic, engineering challenges and the funding to do that, I just decided that, look, let me put up this idea and see what the public thinks about it and see if we can, if there is a way to promote this idea and see if that's possible and we generate a discussion. And then, as you may have seen in the paper, I realized within the region we have Australia pushing what they call the Northern Australia policy, and then we have China pushing the Silk Maritime Road. So why not now we have this North-South Road, so that we have, from the northern side, we have easy access to the northern part of Asia. From the middle, we have direct link to the middle part of Asia, and then now the Southeast Asia, and Australia and New Zealand, and so that sort of promotes an integrated economic trade connection.
Yes. Do you think there would be an imbalance in terms of who would benefit more from opening up those borders, putting aside all the cultural security concerns?
I don't think there would be an imbalance. In fact, the starting point for both countries is not the same. As you correctly pointed out, you see, the Jayapura side is far more developed than Panimo, you see. And a lot of activities take place in Jayapura and nothing much in Panimo. So this will put both countries on an equal footing at both sides of the border and create opportunities for both sides of the border. And in terms of that, the short linkage that you are that you are talking about, you can see so restricted and is so isolated. Panimo is too far to connect with the rest of PNG. So after people bring things from say Jayapura to Panimo, so that's why I'm talking about opening up this island with it.
Looking realistically now, could this be achieved given the current security concerns, the cultural concerns in West Papua, and would Papua New Guinea or Indonesia, for that matter, ever consider opening up those borders?
This is the very reason why I've put up this argument. And you see in the paper, I made it very clear. This has great potential. I have serious faith in the technical feasibility of that of the project and the economic benefits of it. The politics, the social, will determine, as you correctly said, whether it's feasible or not.
What kind of feedback have you been getting?
There's some feedback which is more on West Papua. You know, look, we have a West Papua issue. What are we going to do? You're trying to allow create another problem, or, you know, that kind of surrounding West Papua, the kind of issues you raised. One or two comments talking about the social, the engineering side of the issue. There are others who are realizing and saying, look, this is an interesting idea we've never thought about. It's worth thinking and discussing and let's have a talk through. When I first presented the idea of having township development, they called me a communist in 2002. So I still have that memory. But you know, the current prime minister, the current government, is actually pushing township development, and he's actually set up four cities now, going for a cities approach, Agen City, Lay City, Kokopo City bills. So he's actually pushing a township, and it has taken, I'm not saying that I've directly influenced, but my writings and my ideas have been around, and people have seen it, and there's a couple of people starting to realize that there's no way we will cover each of these parts of PNG trying to deliver health, education, electricity, all of that. What we need is a city's approach and effective mobilization of land around those and promoting an integrated living. So that's when I now elevated, say, look, if we try to promote this, then we need international connection. We need to be connected to the fastest economies of the world and the developed economies.
A group fighting for media freedom in the Pacific says free and fair access to media should come higher up on the list of considerations for election observers. The Pacific Freedom Forum says two groups of observers judged Nauru's recent election free and fair despite a de facto ban on foreign media and curbs on opposition members. The forum's Jason Brown told Sally Round, international media access to cover elections is crucial to a free and fair election, and it's strange that observers didn't mention the restrictions in their interim reports.
Foreign media can often support and help local media ask the questions that they themselves may not be able to ask for fear of offending the wrong people, whether it be private interests or public interests or their immediate boss or relatives or whatever the case may be. It's a check and balance that goes beyond borders. It's ethics without borders, if you like, and diversity and pluralism in media, whether it's a national election or local affairs, is a strength, not a weakness.
The Commonwealth Observers leader, Anote Tong, told us that it's easier for people campaigning in elections to have those face-to-face meetings with their various constituents. That's the setting that they're in. It's different in the Pacific Islands. How does the forum react to that?
Well, it is different in the islands, and we accept, the chairs accept his point that the face-to-face meetings definitely have a role, and that kind of informal setting everyone benefits from, not just people in the Pacific. But what we're saying is that in a small country like Nauru, like our Pacific states, even the bigger ones, we're all closely connected and people may not feel comfortable, let alone confident, of asking their elected representatives hard questions, especially the ones that happen to be in power.
These observers haven't put out their full reports yet. These are just interim reports. So obviously they're not giving the full picture of what they've seen. Would you not give them the benefit of the doubt that they may be raising these media issues a bit further down the track?
Hopefully they will. From what the forum has seen in the past, though, these reports tend to name-check the importance of the media alongside civil society, gender rights and so forth. Not that they're all not important issues. What we're saying is that the media is the main avenue for these issues to be raised and should thus take a higher priority. With the concerns about the opposition too and their freedom of expression, as noted by the Parliamentary Union, there's a widespread silencing of political opposition. This is what's happened in Nauru, and hopefully the electoral observers will also take note of that. To then declare an election free and fair seems to be a very generous assessment of what actually happened there. So if that's their preliminary view, hopefully they'll take a more perhaps sceptical and deeper look at what really goes into free and fair elections, including full access for the media.
One of the things the group has raised is that there seems to be little understanding of the role of the Fourth Estate in elections. So do you think that perhaps this is something you might be able to suggest, that journalists are included among observer groups in future in elections in the region?
Certainly, although I thought that was already the case. Forgive me my ignorance. It seems that politicians, watching politicians is enough, and we must note that at least one of the observers has previously been the subject of a PFF alert in terms of media freedom in his own country when he was previously leader. Perhaps the electoral observer missions need checks and balances and greater diversity themselves.
A photography project which documented a Samoan village over a 20-year period will soon be on exhibition in New Zealand and Samoa. Auckland-based Samoan photographer Iviota Tamu has received an artist residency at the National University of Samoa, which she will use to complete her project this year. Her artist residency is part of a partnership with Creative New Zealand and will begin next month. She spoke to Indira Stewart about the start of the project.
I say officially around 1994, but I started taking photographs of my village back in the late 80s
right.
when I got my first proper SLR 35mm camera.
Right. And did you start it with the intention of carrying it on to a 20-year journey documenting the village and its changes?
Heck no. No, I started it because I just wanted to record what people looked like. I'm the same as my father. He was really interested in our family history. So he would write things down and interview certain family members. And for me, it was really about recording what people looked like before people died or moved away or became old.
So this journey documents things like the generational change in the village, young kids being born, young kids back then who possibly are now adults with families of their own, older people who have passed on to new life, just that cycle of life in the village?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I've actually seen children pretty much grow up. Like when I've seen their parents as young, you know, they were teenagers and parents get together and they have their own children. So I've seen children grow up in my photographs and they're married themselves, they've got their own children and are, you know, living somewhere else. A lot of my photographs, when I say they're not snapshots, but they're kind of the everyday life photographs, at the time that I took them, it was they're not that important. Compound that by, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years later, I've got a lot of requests from like great-grandchildren of people that I've photographed, and it's like, oh, man, I don't even know who these people are.
Wow, and in terms of some of those significant changes in the village community over the past two decades, what are some other kind of village life changes that have really come out in your photos?
Motor vehicles, televisions, where people didn't have televisions, like electricity pretty much. I remember when our village had its first street lamp and the youth were so against it. They didn't like it because they said it was weird to have light at nighttime. And so they smashed the light bulb. They said the only light we want to see at night is moonlight. And eventually people got over that because everyone has electricity in their houses now. So where cooking used to happen mainly outdoors, then the little kerosene ovens were being bought and used inside the house. So, yeah, things like television, people who had cars were really wealthy, but now people have got one or two cars in their homes. Everybody's got pretty much a cell phone and connected via Facebook or some sort of social media.
Are there any things that surprisingly haven't changed in those photos over the years?
It still looks the same. Like the houses fundamentally are still the same. There's just little things like a flat screen TV that's in there now. The village meetings are still the same. And the Sunday after church committee lunches that would happen with the Matai lunches and the Matai's wives and then the young men and the other young women in the village. But that still looks the same. Going to church in the morning service and the afternoon service still looks the same, except there are people who are being driven to church now instead of walking. There's things that are missing in my photographs. Things like funerals, weddings, birthdays, some major sort of celebrations that I just haven't had time to be around there to capture. So given that I've got 3 months, a lot can happen in 3 months in Samoa. I mean, anything happens in Samoa.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition, the weekly version of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to let us know what you think of the program, or if you've heard our new time and frequency for the Caribbean, Latin America, and the southern part of the United States at 22 hours UTC on Friday on 9955 kilohertz, do let us know, and we will send you an EQSL for the program. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.